All right, welcome back to the deep dive. We love getting into the nitty-gritty with you guys, especially on those legal topics that can seem, well, a little daunting at first glance.
Definitely. And today we're diving headfirst into a case that honestly might make your head spin a bit. It's got it all. Surety bonds, the Miller Act, third-party beneficiaries, a real grab bag of legal goodies. Buckle up, folks.
That sounds like a wild ride. So, what's the case we're dissecting today, and why should our listeners, especially those of you knee-deep in law school, care?
Today's deep dive is all about Saucony Vacuum Oil Co. v. Continental Casualty Co. And let me tell you, this case throws a real curveball when it comes to the question of who can sue on a surety bond, especially when you've got this interplay between the Miller Act, which is federal law, and private contracts. It's a case that really forces you to think about how contract language can have some serious and sometimes surprising legal consequences, especially in that messy world of construction law.
Okay, so it sounds like we're dealing with a situation where someone's trying to get paid, but there are a few roadblocks in their way, maybe a missed deadline or two.
You got it. So imagine you're a supplier, and you've provided materials for a big construction project. You're expecting to get paid, but then, surprise, surprise, the subcontractor who hired you stiffed you on the bill.
Classic construction drama. Been there, heard that.
Right. Now what do you do? Well, if it's a federal project, you've probably heard of the Miller Act. It's this federal law that requires prime contractors on those projects to post a payment bond as a way to protect folks like suppliers and laborers.
So the Miller Act's kind of like a safety net, making sure those down the chain get paid, even if a subcontractor goes belly up. Makes sense.
Exactly. But there's a catch. You've got to file your claim within a strict 90-day deadline. Miss that deadline, and you might think you're out of luck. But in Saucony Vacuum, the supplier tries a different tactic. They set their sights on a different bond altogether.
Oh, so there's a twist in the tale. This is getting good.
Hold on tight. So the supplier in this case is Saucony Vacuum Oil Company. They provided materials to a subcontractor named R.F. Carpenter, Inc., who, as you might have guessed, didn't pay their bills. Now, the prime contractor for this whole project was Bennett Stewart Company, and yes, they had their Miller Act bond in place like they were supposed to, but Saucony, well, they missed that 90-day deadline to go after that bond.
Oof, that's got a sting. So what did Saucony do? Throw in the towel?
Nope, they got creative. Remember how I mentioned there was another bond involved? Well, see, Bennett Stewart, the prime contractor, had required their subcontractor, Carpenter, to get their own separate surety bond. And that bond was issued by Continental Casualty Company.
Okay, so we've got two bonds in play here. The Miller Act bond for the prime contractor and the separate bond for the subcontractor. And so Saucony, having missed their shot at the Miller Act bond, is going after the subcontractor's bond instead. That's pretty savvy.
Right. It's not the usual move, and it raises a big legal question. Can a supplier who's missed out on the Miller Act protection actually sue on this separate subcontractor bond? And if so, what does that mean for the way we understand these bonds and the rights they create? All right, law students, this is where it gets juicy. We've got our setup, the players, the missed deadline, and a supplier going for an unexpected legal play. But before we get into the court's decision, let's lay out the central legal issue here.
Sure. So the Second Circuit Court of Appeals had to grapple with a very specific question. Can a material supplier, in this case Saucony, sue a subcontractor surety directly for payment on the bond, even though they failed to file a timely claim under the Miller Act against the prime contractor's bond? It's a mouthful, but it boils down to whether Saucony has a valid claim against Continental based on the language of that separate surety bond.
Got it. So it's all about whether this separate bond gives Saucony a direct right to sue, completely independent of the Miller Act. Big stakes. So what did the court decide? Did Saucony pull it off? Drum roll, please. The Second Circuit said yes. So Cody can sue Continental directly. And their reasoning is really interesting. They focused on the plain, everyday language of the bond itself. The bond said that Continental was obligated to pay all labor and material obligations of Carpenter. The court said, look, the bond says what it says. They weren't interested in trying to guess at some hidden intention. The plain meaning of the words was clear.
So it wasn't about what Continental might have wanted the bond to cover. It was about what they actually wrote down in black and white.
Exactly. And this is where things get kind of fascinating for anyone studying contracts.
Yeah.
The court even rejected the argument that this bond was only meant to protect Bennett Stewart, the prime contractor who required Carpenter to get it in the first place. They said, nope, If the bond promises to pay for materials, then it protects the folks who supplied those materials. Pretty straightforward logic.
Yeah, I mean, if you're promising to pay for materials, it makes sense that the folks who provided those materials would have a right to say, hey, where's my money?
Exactly. And here's the key distinction that the Second Circuit really hammered home. The Miller Act and the private surety bond are two separate beasts. The Miller Act is a federal law with its own rules and deadlines. But that bond between Carpenter and Continental, that was a completely separate private contract. So Pulmy might have missed the boat on the Miller Act, but that didn't automatically shut the door on their rights under this other agreement.
So Cutting essentially had two chances to get paid. Mm-hmm. One under the Miller Act, which they missed, and another under the separate contract, which they didn't. Fascinating.
And remember, this is a big deal because it means that these subcontractor bonds, even though they might be required by the prime contractor, can actually create rights for parties who aren't even directly involved in the agreement, like suppliers. It's a powerful illustration of how contract language can really expand the circle of protection.
So the court's saying that even though Bennett Stewart made Carpenter get the bond, the way it was written actually gave Sacani a direct line to Continental.
Right. And the court wasn't buying any arguments about, oh, well, that wasn't really the intention. They stuck to the plain meaning of the words in the bond, which is a huge principle of contract interpretation.
And there was also something in the opinion about the court not wanting to give Continental an unearned windfall. What was that all about?
Yes. So the court basically pointed out that if they ruled against Saucony, Continental would essentially be getting off scot-free. They issued this bond, presumably collected a nice premium for it, and made a promise to pay. The court wasn't about to let them wriggle out of that obligation just because Saucony missed a deadline related to a completely different law. That wouldn't have been fair.
So they were looking at the bigger picture, making sure Continental didn't get to avoid paying what they had essentially contracted to pay. That makes sense.
Absolutely. Now let's step back for a second and think about the broader implications of this case. For our listeners, especially those future lawyers out there, what are the big takeaways from Saucony Vacuum? What should you be scribbling down in your notes right now?
Yeah, break it down for us. What's the big picture?
All right, here's the deal. Don't underestimate the power of those words in a contract, especially when it comes to surety bonds. Seriously, those little words can have huge consequences. Don't just assume who's protected and who isn't. You've got to read the language carefully because sometimes, like in this case, it can create direct legal rights for third parties, even if those parties weren't at the negotiating table when the contract was drafted.
It's like those hidden clauses in the fine print. You never know what kind of power they hold.
You got it. And here's another layer to think about. This case also shows how different sources of legal rights can work together. You've got statutory rights, like those from the Miller Act, and you've got contractual rights. They can both exist at the same time, offering multiple layers of protection. It's a good reminder that missing out on one avenue doesn't mean all is lost. There might be another legal path available if you know where to look.
And in this case, that path was paved with the specific language of that subcontractor's bond.
Exactly. It makes you wonder how this case might have changed the way these bonds are written today. You can bet that surety companies sat up and took notice after Sacony Vacuum.
Oh.
They probably started being a lot more careful about the language they used, making sure it was clear who they intended to protect and under what conditions.
It's like a ripple effect. A court decision can reshape entire industries.
Absolutely. But here's a question that some folks might have. Does a ruling like this, where a supplier can bypass the Miller Act and still get paid, somehow undermine the purpose of the Miller Act? I mean, isn't the Miller Act supposed to be that ironclad protection for suppliers on federal projects?
It's a valid point. What do you think?
Well, the Second Circuit seemed to think that the two mechanisms can work side by side. The Miller Act still serves its purpose. It requires that prime contractor bond, which is a huge safety net. But the Sacony Vacuum shows that these subcontractor bonds can offer an additional independent layer of protection. Think of it like a backup plan. You always want to try to meet those Miller Act deadlines, but if something goes wrong, this case shows that there might be another option available as long as the language of that subcontractor's bond supports it.
So it doesn't weaken the Miller Act, it just adds another potential layer of protection into the mix.
Exactly. The key takeaway here, and I can't stress this enough, is that in law, details matter. Words matter. It's all about careful reading, understanding the nuances of contract language and recognizing that legal rights can arise from multiple sources.
Well said. I think that's a lesson worth remembering for everyone, not just lawyers. So Coney Vacuum is a fascinating case, and thanks for breaking it down for us.
My pleasure. It's a classic example of how seemingly small details in legal documents can have massive consequences.
And on that note, we've reached the end of our deep dive. But before we sign off, here's something for you to ponder. We talked a lot about how the plain meaning of contract language can create unexpected rights and obligations. How might this principle apply to other areas of law, maybe even in your own life? Think about contracts you sign, agreements you enter into, even those terms and conditions we all scroll past without reading. The words matter, and understanding them can be the key to unlocking rights and protections you might not even realize you have. So stay curious, folks, and keep an eye on that fine print. Until next time.